differ clearly in the characteristic feelings that attend them, and in the demeanor of the person affected by them. Hope swells outward, fear shrinks back. But if they have basically the same idea, namely that a valued outcome is uncertain, and if it isn't the probabilities that make the difference, what is the difference in the person's thoughts and attitudes that results in or is accompanied by this difference of feeling? It appears that the difference is one of focus. It's like the glass is half empty, the glass is half full. The same glass, a different focus of vision. In fear, you focus on the bad outcome that may occur. In hope, you focus on the good. A recent book by philosopher Adrienne Martin, called How We Hope, A Moral Psychology, adds a very important point. Hope, Martin argues, is more like a syndrome than just an attitude or emotion. It includes thoughts, imaginings, preparations for action, even actions. I don't see this as peculiar to hope. Fear also has strong connections to imagination and action. But what are the actions and thoughts characteristic of hope? I'd say that hope involves a vision of the good world that might ensue, and, often at least, actions related to getting there. Some of these might be similar to the actions prompted by fear, since warding off a bad possibility can be very similar to promoting a good one. Fear of danger, when it is proportional and healthy, prompts evasive strategies that can make safety and health more likely. Still, there is a difference. The patient who is full of fear may become paralyzed. A hopeful patient may be more energetic in seeking solutions. And maybe, though we still know too little about this, the hope itself is efficacious. The placebo effect shows that at least in many situations, thinking one is going to get better produces real improvement. Hope does not rest on such probabilistic beliefs, as I've said, but it might be similarly effective. Martin's idea about the connection between hope and positive action is powerful, but hope does not always work this way. Sometimes hoping is inert and impotent, and may even distract from useful work. In academic life, we all know people who live in hope. They hope that someday they will write something good. They imagine themselves reading a fine article that they have produced. They see it set in type in the pages of the Journal of Philosophy, etc. But that sort of thing can be self-indulgent fantasy, or even a substitute for getting down to work. In such cases, we would be right to prefer the person who works without any particular emotional attitude to the person who indulges in emotion and fantasy without work. We need then to distinguish, as Martin does not, between what we might call idle hope and what we might call practical hope. Hope that is firmly linked to and that energizes a commitment to action. But while idle hope surely exists, hope can often be truly practical. The beautiful imaginings and fantasies involved in hoping can energize action toward the valuable goal. It's hard to sustain commitment to a difficult struggle without such energizing thoughts and feelings. The difference between fearing and hoping is slender. It's like flipping a switch. Now the glass looks half full. And these mental images, often at least, do important practical work, preparing me to take action toward the valuable goal and convincing me that it's within reach. That's what I was doing, I guess, on June 15th, in the face of a drumbeat of bad news, summoning up things to focus on that are beautiful and good and connected to valuable goals of constructive work and reconciliation, with the result that I became more serene and unwavering in my ongoing pursuit of those goals. Hope as a practical postulate. Why on earth should we hope? The world does not give us reasons for that attitude. And I've already said that hope is not a matter of probability calculation. There is always a choice. Which images shall I focus on? What thoughts shall I summon up in my mental space? One reason for hoping is the likely placebo effect. Sometimes hope, in and of itself, can make the good outcome more likely. But there's no placebo effect in politics. Hoping that person P or legislation L will make America great again, or improve your employment or health situation, doesn't by itself make those results more likely. So why not just be glum and cynical, expecting the worst? There is less disappointment that way. This sounds suspiciously like the Stoic view. Don't care about uncertain things too much. And we already said that this was bad because it means renouncing love, whether of people or of a country. If you focus fearfully, ahead of time, on the possible failure of your marriage, what sort of marriage could that be? So, a first reason for hope is that it keeps love and trust alive, and love is valuable. A further argument was made by Immanuel Kant. Kant believed that we have a duty during our lives to engage in actions that produce valuable social goals, actions that make it more likely that human beings will treat one another as ends, not as mere instruments. Central in his own thinking was the aim of producing world peace. But Kant also understood and plainly felt in his heart that when we look around us, it is difficult to sustain our own efforts. We see so much bad behavior, so much hatred, human beings everywhere falling so far short of what we might wish human beings to be and do. He said that if we asked our own hearts the question, is the human race as a whole likable, or is it an object to be regarded with distaste? We just don't know what to say. Among the other evils Kant attacks are arbitrary monarchy, the slave trade, self-aggrandizing nationalism, and the absence of religious freedom and the freedom of speech. But if we ought to be pursuing valuable social goals, then we ought to motivate ourselves to pursue them. And this means embracing hope. So Kant concludes that we should choose hope as what he calls a practical postulate, an attitude that we take on without sufficient reasons, for the sake of the good action it may enable. However uncertain I may be, and may remain, as to whether we can hope for anything better for mankind, this uncertainty cannot detract from the maxim I have adopted, or from the necessity of assuming for practical purposes that human progress is possible. This hope for better times to come, without which an earnest desire to do something useful for the common good would never have inspired the human heart, has always influenced the activities of right-thinking people. Kant is right. Good works need hope. When you have a child, you have no idea, really, what sort of person your child will become, or what sort of life he or she will have. But you know that you want to be a good parent, so you embrace hope. Practical hope, not idle hope, since you get to work to produce a good future for your child. But could you do that without hope? Kant says plausibly that you could not. When you love a cause or a country, once again you need to embrace hope to sustain you in your efforts on its behalf. Think of Martin Luther King Jr., of Gandhi, of the founders of the United States, of Nelson Mandela. All people of hope and vision who saw a beautiful future and worked energetically to realize it. Despair, or even cynical resignation, are attitudes incompatible with bold action and committed work. We're talking about people committed to genuinely good causes. Hope itself is neutral. Criminals have hope. Dictators, tax evaders, fanatics of all sorts have hope. Indeed, we wish these people didn't have so much high hope, since they might then be less energetic in pursuing their bad goals. A languid, timorous Hitler would probably have done little damage to the world. Whereas the hopeful, visionary Hitler did untold damage. I'm saying that hope is crucial to the energetic pursuit of a difficult goal. And then, if the goal is a genuinely valuable one, and if we agree with Kant that we ought to live in a way that promotes genuinely valuable goals, we have a very powerful reason to embrace hope. Hope really is a choice and a practical habit. Any human situation, any marriage, any job, any friendship is always a mixture of good and bad. How we engage with it often depends on our emotional focus. You can always say to yourself, "This is terrible and I am miserable," focusing on the ways in which that part of your life fails to meet your ideal. Or you can say, "This is pretty great," focusing on the part that really is great. Similarly, facing the future, you can say, "This is likely to be a mess," and face the future with fear. Or you can say, "This can be really wonderful," and then you embrace hope for the future of that friendship or that job. Hope, the opposite of fear. We've said from the start that hope is the opposite or flip side of fear. Both react to uncertainty, but in opposing ways. Their action tendencies are for that reason very different. Hope expands and surges forward. Fear shrinks back. Hope is vulnerable. Fear, self-protective. Of course, it is likely that everyone will have pockets of fear, even amid hope. I can be hopeful for my children, my friendships, my family, and yet fearful about my health or the health of a friend. So what we are talking about here is the difference between hope and fear directed at the same goal, and in this case the future of my country in its efforts toward justice and flourishing. Directed at the same outcomes, hope and fear are extremely different, and it really is like flipping a switch. I can't hope and fear for the same thing at the same time, although I can certainly oscillate between periods of hope and periods of fearfulness. I've said from the beginning that fear is connected to the monarchical desire to control others rather than to trust them to be independent and themselves. Similarly, the person who refuses to hope for the future is likely to be a controlling sort of person, what I've called a monarchical person. Nothing is good unless it dovetails entirely with my wishes. With no pockets of uncertainty and vulnerability. No hope here because I don't have the entirety of what I want, and I don't want to depend on other unreliable people or on chance. The spirit of hope, then, is obscurely linked to a spirit of respect for the independence of others, to a renunciation of monarchical ambition, a kind of relaxation and expansion of the heart. The Stoics said that hope was expansion and uplift. Poets connect hope with soaring and flying. The Indian poet-philosopher Rabindranath Tagore once said of a young woman getting married that she was stepping into the waters of chance, unafraid. That's what hope involves. Put in political terms, democracy surely involves some fear, and fear can be a useful guide in many areas of democratic life when the underlying facts are right. Fear of terrorism, fear of unsafe highways and bridges, fear of the loss of freedom itself. All of these can prompt useful protective action. But directed to the very future of the democratic project itself, a fearful approach is likely to be dangerous, leading people to seek autocratic control or the protection of someone who will control outcomes for them. Martin Luther King Jr. understood that a fearful approach to the future of race relations would play straight into the hands of those who sought to manage things by violence, a kind of preemptive strike. His emphasis on hope was an attempt to flip the switch, getting people to dwell mentally on good outcomes that could come about through peaceful work and cooperation. On June 15th, I threw myself into the waters of chance, reinforcing my commitment to some totally uncertain things and embracing them with a vision of how the world could be, as King says, a world where men and women can live together. We have to do this every day, if we are really serious about the pursuit of difficult and noble goals. Crazy, but, as Kant says, necessary. Hope's relatives, faith and love. Hope is closely connected to two other emotional attitudes, faith and love. Christian thought traditionally links these three, and St. Paul adds that the greatest of the three is love. Martin Luther King Jr. follows Christian teaching by linking the three attitudes, albeit not in a theistic and theological way, but in a this-worldly way that embraces all Americans. Why faith, then? And what could King have meant? What can we mean today by this-worldly faith? I say that hope does not rest on probabilities, and indeed is pretty independent of any specific attitude as to how likely the outcome is. Not entirely independent, however. We need to believe that the good things we hope for have a realistic chance of being realized through the efforts of flawed human beings. If we think that justice is possible only in heaven, this inhibits our efforts in this life. So, King had to go against one strand in the Christian tradition, urging his followers to have this worldly faith, that what they were doing, protesting and marching, could actually bear fruit, and preferably in their lifetimes. Otherwise, hard work and risk-taking action seem not worth it. So too with us today. If we think that democratic politics has gone down the drain, and that our efforts are a waste of time, we won't embrace hope. Faith of this sort does not need to be, and should not be, utopian or unrealistic. We may not believe that the goal will be accomplished quickly, and we may not even think that it will be fully realized in our time, but we probably need to think that meaningful progress is a plausible expectation if we work hard. But the goal itself must not be conceived in an unrealistic way, as a type of perfect justice that human beings can't sustain. Such hopes all too often lead to cynicism or despair. Real human beings and real human life are what we need to believe in. And that means that hope, bolstered by faith, needs to embrace something that flawed human beings are capable of and might really do. Think of King's speech again. The I Have a Dream speech is soaring idealistic poetry, expressing faith in a beautiful goal, and asking us all to embrace that goal with hope. But what does King actually ask us to imagine? Only this, that in Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. Not that they will agree with one another in all respects. Not that systemic racism will be a thing of the past. Only that people will sit down together to talk. That, in our own time, is real. Only this, that in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. That doesn't happen 100% of the time, obviously, but it can happen, and often does happen, right there in Alabama. So that, too, in our own time, is real, and made dramatically real in December 2017 by the election of Democrat Doug Jones to the Senate, defeating racist Roy Moore, thanks in large part to the vigorous support of African-American voters, newly empowered. King asks us to believe in the possibility of small, daily human acts of brotherhood, not a perfect world. The real is made beautiful, and that is what hope embraces. Utopianism is a forerunner of despair, so faith and hope need to find beauty in the near. So too with my thoughts on June 15th. My hope and its accompanying faith remain indefinite, as they had better do, but the things on which they focus, better lives for African-American young people on the south side of Chicago, at least some good legislative deliberations about the common good, are surely just as possible as the changes King envisaged in the Deep South. The Danny Massing song asks for a new loving spirit, committed to building bridges. And that is surely difficult. But I don't need to believe that everyone will love everyone all the time, just often enough to make a difference. So, hope needs faith, but faith need not be, and had better not be, based on an unrealistic view of people. There's a more subtle kind of faith that we need in human relations. If faith is, as St. Paul said, the evidence of things not seen, then we need faith any time we engage with another person in a more than casual way. We need, that is, to treat that other person as a person, having depth and an inner life, a point of view on the world, and emotions similar to our own. What we see is just a shape, moving and making sounds. Even before automata were a reality, people made up stories about them. They even appear in Homer's Iliad. People were fascinated by the inscrutability of the other, so they wondered how to tell a real person from such a machine. The answer is there is no way to tell. We have to go on faith. Through stories, novels, and poems, we learn how to endow a human form with humanity, and we quickly form the habit of doing so. But it isn't automatic. And it always requires a type of generosity that goes beyond the evidence. This sort of faith, crucial in personal love and friendship, we also need in political life. We need to think of our opponents as having capacities for reasoning and a range of human emotions, whether badly developed and used or not. What about love? Love comes in many types. And we surely do not have to have romantic love for our political opponents, or even the reciprocal liking characteristic of friendly love. King said this countless times so that he would not be misunderstood. But there is a type of love that is closely linked to the faith I've just described. A love that simply consists in seeing the other person as fully human, and capable at some level of good and of change. If you don't have love for others, then the life of stoic detachment or even cynical despair will make more sense than the life of hope, with its many demands. So there is a kind of base level of love that is needed, even before people take an interest in hope. But as habits of hope develop, they are sustained by and further sustain habits of love, a generosity of spirit that practices seeing good in others and expecting good things rather than expecting the worst. As King often noted, this sort of love is assisted by learning to separate the doer from the deed. Deeds may be denounced unequivocally. People are always larger than their deeds, capable of growth and change. It would be hard to find a person in politics who had seen more human evil than Nelson Mandela. Oppressed for most of his life by the brutal racism of South African apartheid, imprisoned for 27 years, much of that in deplorable conditions on Robben Island. He saw a lot of human badness. And yet, throughout his life, Mandela remained a man of hope, faith, and love. In prison, he struggled against mental bitterness and toward hope by thinking about how people were capable of working together for good ends. He meditated on such things in a habitual way. He cultivated understanding of his oppressors by learning the Afrikaans language. All of this led to a remarkable demeanor in politics, one that always did separate the doer from the deed, showing that he believed in the good possibilities inherent in all. And such was the power of his generous and hopeful demeanor, he actually elicited such behavior more often than not. As his funeral procession wound through the streets, a white police officer, tears running down his cheeks, recalled how Mandela had been driven through the streets on the occasion of his inauguration as president in 1994. His car passed by a group of young police recruits, including the speaker, who said he was expecting only hatred and scorn. Mandela got down from his car and shook the hands of all the young men, smiling his winning smile and saying, "Our trust is in you." Again and again, the warmth of his personality moved people to the core. The coach and players of the national rugby team, well depicted in the movie Invictus, the chief of South African security, even the jailer who had to cook for him in his final prison. More like a hotel, since it was clear by then that he would be president. Feeling that they were seen as capable of good, people usually tried to live up to that expectation. Mandela's stance combined our three attitudes. During a long, dark period, with an uncertain future, he embraced hope. He did so, it seems, through an unwavering faith in the prospects of his troubled nation, not for perfect justice, but for the ultimate rejection of apartheid in favor of multiracial democracy. At its deepest level, though, both faith and hope were sustained by Mandela's almost heroic capacity for love, for seeing the potential for good in his fellow countrymen, white and black, and embracing them in the light of that possibility. Mandela is a heroic figure, but we don't have to aspire to that extraordinary generosity in adversity. We just need to move in that direction. And we can do that right now, today. Getting in the habit of seeing people who thwart us, not as monsters, but as thinking and feeling real people who are not totally evil. I notice this in my extended family where there are large political differences. I find that the very fact that people basically love me means that they do not trash my arguments in the way that they are used to trashing arguments from others on the left. Now, of course, this movement from love into some sort of listening and exchange is fragile. The vitriol might spill back into the family love, tainting and spoiling it. I'm sure this happens often. But the opposite possibility exists, and we can cultivate it. From a vision of a person as real and potentially lovable, we can get to the hope for a real dialogue. Let's think again now about disgust. Mandela seems to have been unusually free of bodily disgust. Thus, he volunteered to dispose of wastes in the Robben Island prison when one of his fellow prisoners could not bear to do it. This acceptance of the body may have helped him avoid projecting disgust onto any people or group, including racist whites. Projective disgust is a denial of love and faith. It says, "This is an animal, not a full human being." Racist South Africans said that all the time, and it would have been easy for Mandela to reciprocate. But he always preserved his faith that behind the looming shapes of his oppressors were real human feelings and many aims for good despite the bad deeds. Political hope requires putting disgust on hold. It's easy to say this in theory, difficult to achieve it. Many of my students are full of disgust at Trump and Trump supporters, and many of my academic colleagues are too. Nor do they imagine the full humanity of those human beings, or separate their deeds from the person behind the deeds. As Mandela and King show us, we can unequivocally condemn racism without viewing racists as irredeemably evil. As long as we can see one another this way, we won't have faith in future good emerging. And we won't have the sort of love that envisages possibilities of cooperation and brotherhood. And that means that we will not follow Kant's advice and embrace hope. What practices relevant to good citizenship might we encourage as we seek to flip the switch from fear to hope? And in particular, hope connected to constructive work and bridge-building dialogue. Early in this chapter, I asked myself what institutions in our society gave me, personally, reasons for hope. Here, I'm asking a different but related question. What are, so to speak, the schools of hope, areas of our common life, that we should encourage and strengthen on the grounds that they help people sustain or embrace hope? Much of the work of sustaining or building hope is done in families and in personal friendships of many kinds, but there are five, at least, that we can look to as we try to sustain hope for a decent future. Poetry, music and the other arts, critical thinking, in schools, universities, and adult discussion groups of many kinds, religious groups insofar as they practice love and respect for others, solidarity groups focused on securing justice in a nonviolent and dialogical way, and, often closely connected to such groups, theories of what justice is, accounts of the goal that we can focus on to enrich our efforts. Each practice has bad as well as good exemplars, but each contains huge potential for a hopeful future. I'll argue, though, that all ought to be supplemented by a sixth practice of citizenship, a national service program required of all young people that would put young citizens into close contact with people different in age, ethnicity, and economic level, in the context of constructive service. Politically unpopular as it no doubt is, I believe that this solution is urgently important. Practices of Hope, the Arts. First, let's deepen a theme that formed part of Winnicott's account of mature concern and of my own anti-disgust proposal. Walt Whitman, who might be called our national poet, said that these states need poets because the poet is the arbiter of the diverse, the equalizer of his age and land. By Blue Ontario's Shore, Section 10. What Whitman meant is that poets have the professional habit of love in the sense that I have described it. That is, they see whatever they see as full, real, and infinitely complex, and as separate from the ego. Love, in this sense, is anti-narcissistic, determined to cede an area of mystery and infinite complexity to each other, and determined to let each speak, act, and be. He sees eternity in men and women. He does not see men and women as dreams or dots, says Whitman, implicitly contrasting his poems of America with other more bureaucratic practices. A runaway slave is fully present as a real and complex feeling person. A woman's desire for freedom is present too, and the gay man's longing for fulfillment. Other discourses useful to politics, Whitman suggests, do not contain this sense of boundless richness, so if all we read is, say, economic treatises, We risk losing something precious about the humanity of human beings. Artists may, of course, have a blinkered or mistaken political vision. Some have been sexist, some anti-Semitic, some racist. Whitman is not saying that art is unerring. He is saying instead that insofar as the poet does engage poetically with a human being, exploring those mysterious insides and inviting us to do so, thus far the poet offers a practice for democratic citizenship. This theme has been developed by many literary artists. African-American novelist Ralph Ellison, in a later introductory essay about his great novel, Invisible Man, described his novel as a raft of hope, perception, and entertainment, on which America's democracy may negotiate the snags and whirlpools that stand between us and the democratic ideal. The image of the raft is a rich one, alluding to the trip down the Mississippi taken by Huck Finn and the slave Jim, during which each learns something of how the world looks through the other's eyes, and grows to see the other not as a looming shape or inert body, but as a reservoir of human thoughts and feelings. Ellison's novel is centrally a novel about vision and blindness. His hero, an unnamed African-American, opens the novel by saying, "I am an invisible man." He then explains that he is not a ghost. He has a body, and might even be said to possess a mind. He is invisible simply because people refuse to see me. It's as if he is surrounded by mirrors in which people see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination, everything and anything except me. Why? That invisibility to which I refer occurs because of a peculiar disposition of the eyes of those with whom I come in contact. A matter of the construction of their inner eyes, those eyes with which they look through their physical eyes on reality. Ellison's novel addresses the inner eyes of its mainly white readership, not through sentimentality or easy empathy, but through scorching satire, fantastic hyperbolic humor, all in the service of a deeper and more difficult sympathy. What Ellison's later essay suggests is that the insight is inseparable from the fictional craft. Let me give just one more example of this theme. Israeli novelist David Grossman, the 2017 winner of the Man Booker International Prize, gave a speech at the graduation ceremony at Hebrew University on June 11, 2017, addressing the role of the novelist in a profoundly divided society. He was receiving an honorary doctorate, as was I, and had been invited to reply on behalf of all the honorees. He spoke in Hebrew, with simultaneous English translation. Grossman said that his creative profession offers the possibility of touching infinity, not some heavenly infinity, but the infinite complexity that wholeness made up of infinite flaws, with defects and deficiencies of both mind and body, the endless possibilities and ways of being inside life that characterize any single human being. He then described his painful struggle to understand and convey one of his most famous characters, Aura, the heroine of Grossman's much-praised novel, To the End of the Land. He felt that he was trying to get at her psyche, but there was a blockage. Eventually he came to understand that the problem was his own desire for total control, his desire to impose a meaning on a separate life. Finally he understood. It was not Aura who had to submit to me, but I who had to submit to her. In other words, I had to stop resisting the possibility of Aura inside me. This sense of openness and vulnerability before the infinite complexity of the human, Grossman suggests, is an author's gift to his nation. His prize-winning new novel, A Horse Walks Into a Bar, is another tour de force of imaginative surrender, as its narrator, a guilt-ridden, cynical stand-up comic, speaks from inside Grossman, in a scathing, relentless, almost unendurable voice, with satire even darker than Ellison's. At that point, the speech turned political, as Grossman expressed his sense that this openness to the full humanity of each person is in grave danger of getting lost in divided Israel, anxious, fear-ridden, full of emotions that block that vision and that vulnerability. He continued in this vein, as many in the audience began booing. At the end, a mere handful gave him a standing ovation. About 10 of the 100 PhD graduates, two of the 11 other honorees, a Belgian physicist and I, and almost nobody in the audience. That response, however, does not show that Grossman's work, and work of other artists, is not a school of hope. Hope often has to begin with a few. And in our own nation, let's hope that fear and blame have not encroached upon hope as far as in today's Israel. Let's hope. And clearly it's not fluff that we need, or even just high-level but easy novels of empathy, such as To Kill a Mockingbird. Ellison was right. The raft has to negotiate snags and whirlpools, so it had better be difficult, often dark, provoking protest and discomfort, as well as tears and gratitude. And the novelist has to be alert to the possibility of co-optation by causes that would corrupt his or her voice. Ellison was accused, I think wrongly, of allowing himself to become the mascot of liberal whites. Grossman will have to watch out lest he become the mascot of those, in Europe especially, who just hate Israel and want the worst rather than the best. I've spoken of poetry and novels. These go to work on our inner eyes in moments of solitary contemplation. But we also need experiences of art in which we are kinetic and active, engaged in making something together. When people come together to sing or dance or to act a play together, or even to sing along with the CD of Hamilton together, as so many kids do, they share breath and bodily contact with one another, promoting a sense of common work and joy. And public works of sculpture and visual art can also involve us in making beauty together, or sharing a sense of the comic vulnerability of bodies. People who visit Chicago's Millennium Park wade in the pool between the two large screens of Jaume Plensa's Crown Fountain, seeing on the screens those huge faces of Chicagoans of different ages and races moving in comic slow motion, and eagerly awaiting the moment when, as if out of the mouth of each face, a jet of cool water sprays out, wetting the waders. Water is a potent metaphor in our divided racial history. The invitation to have fun being sprayed on by a face of a different race or gender includes us all in miscegenation, creating images of how our bitter racial divisions might possibly be overcome. Some nations come together through a sense of ethnic homogeneity, a perilous way to connect in an era of migration. Our nation has always imagined itself as peopled by many different groups, but overcoming fear and suspicion in the direction of real cooperation has never come easily. And the arts offer bridges to seeing human diversity as joyful, funny, tragic, delightful, not as a horrible fate to be shunned. Practices of Hope, the Spirit of Socrates. Socrates said that democracy was a noble but sluggish horse, and that he was like a gadfly, waking it up with his sting. His sting was the demand for rigorous and critical self-examination. Most people then, as now, had a lot of basically good beliefs, and Socrates' entire method relied on this. But Athenian Democrats, like modern Americans, were careless, hasty, prone to overconfident boasting and to substituting invective for argument. The result was, and is, that people don't know what they really believe. They just have not stopped to sort this out. The people Socrates questioned also had bad ways of relating to others, connected to their self-obtuseness. They approach interaction like a contest of boasting, and sought prestige by defeating their opponents in debate. They talked a lot and listened little. Their voices were loud, angry, overconfident. It's no accident that the later Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius compared political discourse to a sports match in which people were cheering for their own team, but nobody was seeking the truth. Socratic reasoning is a practice of hope because it creates a world of listening, of quiet voices, and of mutual respect for reason. Its participants already share a goal: to get the argument right. Both Lacus and Nicias really want to understand what courage is, not simply to make up some flashy tale about courage. I keep remembering a young college student I interviewed back in 1994 or so, when I was writing my book, Cultivating Humanity, about required liberal arts courses. This student, whom I met because he was working behind the desk in my gym, attended a local business college that required all students to take some philosophy courses. He told me he found it really intriguing to be asked to reconstruct the arguments of political speeches and newspaper editorials, detecting fallacies or ambiguous or false premises. But the biggest surprise came when the class staged debates on issues of the day, and he was assigned the job of arguing against the death penalty, although he actually supported it. He told me he had had no idea before that that you could produce arguments for a position you did not hold. What a black mark for our media culture that he had not gotten this idea, although he is a very smart person. That effort to come up with what the other side would say, he told me, changed his whole attitude to political debate. Now he is more likely to respect the other side and to be curious about their reasoning. When the arguments are laid out, it may turn out that both sides share some premises, and we can understand where differences kick in. Our media culture is even more hostile to Socrates than the talk radio culture of 1994. Social media encourage brief blurts of opinion, rather than the working out of a complex argument. The tone is often shrill, as if people are shouting to be heard. People don't listen. Everything is me, me, me. Attention spans, already shortened by many aspects of our technology, constant phone checking, distracted walking and driving, become even shorter, since social media encourage the thought that everything worth saying can be said right away, in a trumpet of self-proclamation. So where do we find these Socratic practices of hope? They still flourish, usually, in the liberal arts programs of our colleges and universities. I have worries, since there is an increasing unwillingness to listen to uncomfortable challenges and a desire to insulate the classroom so that it contains only ideas that students already hold. This demand for safety rather than challenge and critique comes primarily from students, and it should be resisted. I co-teach with my most conservative colleague, the well-known blogger Will Bode, also one of the best young scholars of constitutional law, in order to model a Socratic commitment that truly crosses our political divides. Of course, the classroom should be civil, and debate must not vilify or demean. But that does not mean silencing uncomfortable ideas. Philosophy departments still practice the Socratic virtues for the most part, and some of our top philosophy publishers have encouraged the preparation of pro and con books for students that open up difficult issues in an attractive and civil way. Among other such books, one can find a valuable discussion of climate change in Debating Climate Ethics by Stephen M. Gardner and my colleague, David A. Weisbach, Oxford University Press, of the limits of religious exemption from non-discrimination laws in Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination by Ryan T. Anderson, John Corvino, and Sherif Girgis, Oxford University Press, in Debating Same-Sex Marriage by John Corvino and Maggie Gallagher, Oxford University Press, in Libertarianism, For and Against, by Craig Duncan and Tibor McCann, Roman and Littlefield. We should applaud these authors for sacrificing their time and often their professional search for prestige, since books aimed at teaching are not sources of prestige, in order to perform this public service. Two people who deserve special mention, as examples and among many, are the philosopher John Corvino, who, a gay man and first-rate philosopher, travels all over the country debating conservative opponents with good humor, wit, and excellent arguments, and his opposite number, the great scholar of Jewish thought, David Novak, who cheerfully enters the fray against same-sex marriage and other liberal causes, often in venues where he will be very isolated and unpopular with the audience, again with great good humor, civility, and friendliness. People with tenure don't have to do this sort of thing, and they are rewarded for it only by the satisfaction of practicing hope. Outside the academy, where can Americans find Socrates? In Europe, adults gravitate eagerly to philosophical cafes and public lectures. It always surprises me that I get around 30 people at a book talk in the United States and regularly get 400 or 500 in the Netherlands, and those people are buying tickets. American adults do eagerly seek out continuing education classes in the humanities, and public libraries and bookstores, reinventing themselves for the Amazon era, increasingly feed our hunger for face-to-face conversation. But America is a country of wide spaces that inhibit connection, and I wish we could figure out strategies to draw people into dialogue outside of major urban centers. The isolation of aging people who no longer drive is a large part of this problem. And let's hope that the era of the self-driving car will rapidly diminish isolation. The best attempts on this problem I've seen have come from universities and colleges themselves, creating lecture series and seminars for their communities. Grand Valley State University in Michigan, to take just one example, has a very good debate-focused lecture series, in which a modest donation gives people, in addition, a chance to sit with the speaker in a special reception. Many public universities have similar programs designed to bring the town to the campus. This is no luxury. It is part of being a responsible educational institution in a democracy. I'd add that churches and synagogues also have events that are philosophical and discussion-oriented among the many events they sponsor. I lectured at Old St. Patrick's Church in Chicago in May, a beautiful Romanesque structure that is one of the few Chicago buildings predating the 1871 fire. Founded in 1846, the church, a bastion of Irish-American culture, now hosts events of all types, including a vigorous group for gay and lesbian Catholics and a group for people in Jewish Catholic marriages. But one of their commitments is to philosophy, and they draw a large, diverse public to such discussions. My synagogue, with its words and music program, and other philosophical events, does the same. This brings me to my next topic. Practices of hope, religion. Religions sustain people in many ways in the crises of life and often serve as sources of hope. Not just hope of salvation, if the religion talks of salvation, but also hope for and in our lives with one another on this earth. Let me return to Immanuel Kant, who said that we all have a duty to embrace hope in order to sustain our actions toward love of others, morality, and justice. Kant also thought that it was very difficult to sustain commitment to these goals in isolation. In a group with like-minded other people, it was easier. So, he also said that everyone has a duty to join such a group. He thought that this group had to be a church, united by some type of belief in a higher power. A man of the 18th century, Kant was not very fond of traditional religion. He thought it all too often divided people and encouraged immoral actions. So he thought that the right type of church had to contain a good infusion of Socratic critical argument to stop people from blindly following authority and get them to think for themselves. But he did think that hope was best promoted by a church of the right sort, rather than, say, by civic or social groupings. Kant made some bad mistakes, I think. He was too insistent on religious rationalism, scorning the many ways people connect to good principles through intuition, emotion, and faith. And while he was correct to see big dangers in religious authority, he was wrong to spurn it altogether. Sometimes real people need worldly religious leaders. Finally, he was wrong about the connection between church and state. He thought the government should allow complete religious freedom, but should subsidize only the sort of religion he liked, something that would be unacceptable in our democracy. Still, Kant's basic point seems right. Hope and committed action are difficult in solitude, and religious groups are a primary way in which people find a hope-building and hope-sustaining community. It's no accident that my story of our city focused on the role of the black churches in sustaining hope at a very difficult time of racial division. Can we even imagine that the non-retributive and loving response of those members of the South Carolina Church to the murders by white supremacist Dylann Roof, without thinking of people who attended church together regularly, and whose search for unconditional love was helped by the teaching of a pastor? In my story of my own synagogue, a demographically different and more privileged group, but one with all the conflicts and struggles of human life, of life in Chicago, and of life in America, the group played a key role in sustaining hope for many. We should follow Kant to this extent. We should always ask ourselves where our religion is taking us, and whether that goal is compatible with the love of all persons and a decent national future. But love often follows ritual roots that resonate deeply in memory, and we should be Socratic and skeptical only up to a point. Philosophers sometimes show contempt for religion and religious people. That is one reason they have little public influence in our nation, a deeply religious nation. Our fellow citizens are not stupid or base to embrace religion. We must wish, and this seems as likely as anything good is likely, that each person who embraces religion will find there the ingredients of a hope that is inclusive and loving rather than divisive and retributive. Philosophy by itself shows how we can respect our enemies, it does not show us how to love them. For that, we need the arts, and many of us need religion. Practices of hope, protest movements. People who hope for justice